He was very confused by human society.
We've actually turned into the celebrities that we were not mocking, but, you know, experimenting with.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden. There's a controversial series of photographs by a photographer called Arne Svensson. The series is called The Neighbours, and basically Svensson took photos of people without their consent with a telephoto lens through the windows of their New York City apartments. A man takes a nap on a daybed. A woman looks down to the street below. A dog looks into the middle distance. Now, I know that's wrong. You know that's wrong. We all know that's wrong. But we also know that there's something about voyeurism that's appealing to our nature. Something that makes us want to look into an open window. And that's what we're doing today on All the Best. Looking through windows and trying to see if someone's looking back. And just a heads up, this week's stories both contain strong language. In this first story, we hear from a man who could never quite connect with his father and the emotional barrier between them. Jake Cupid brings us this one.
I grew up with a bit of a strained relationship with my dad. He would always make these grand plans and never follow through. Because this was the only example I had to go on, I've always wondered what kind of man I'd grow up to be. And I've always thought how I would handle being a dad when the time came. My interest in what it means to be a man and masculinity in general started to grow when I was around 22. I studied journalism at uni, and one of my lecturers was a great role model. I'd watch him be genuine and straight to the point, and in the next moment he'd show gentle care and respect. This is the man I wanted to be. I asked if I could talk to him about masculinity, and he ended up opening up to me about the relationship with his father and how they always struggled to connect.
So my father was Asperger's. So he was quite an unusual man, and he found it almost impossible to show, just about impossible to show love. And he was very confused by human society, by emotion, the world of emotion, and the social rules completely passed him by. So he existed in this sort of bubble of himself, and he viewed the outside world only in a very sort of dim kind of way. And he, because he was so confused about the way the world worked, the way the human world worked, his world was a sort of set of concentric circles where the closer people were to him, the more he liked them, and the further away they were from him, the more he simply didn't have a clue, actually. So therefore, that he disliked them. So he was a classic racist. He wasn't racist as most racists are, like sort of Pauline Hanson, which is, you know, thinly disguised racism. This was a man who, yeah, I mean, I could go on, but I mean, this was a, my aunt adopted. My aunt lives in America. She's got an American husband. They adopted foster children, three of whom were black. When she came for dinner, when I was about, no, I would have been quite old actually. When I was probably in my 30s, I was back home for a visit, and we live in the country. My mum still lives in the place that I grew up in, beautiful house with a beautiful garden. And I was sitting outside with my dad, and we were smoking together. It took him a long... He used to smoke a pipe all the time and cigars, and I still smoke occasionally. But so it was a together thing, and he had actually come round to me smoking with him. So it kind of felt like it was a... And he started opening up about his early life, about when he left school, and things I'd never heard of. I was, you know, 30, in my 30s, I'd never heard of this. Telling me about what happened when he left school, how he got a job in Birmingham, and how he met my mum, all this kind of stuff. And it just felt like things were opening up.
William shows me his hands, pressed tightly together, as if to represent how closed off his father was. He slowly parts them. Maybe his father is changing.
And then, it was dusk, it was a summer, you know, English summer, so it was kind of 9 o'clock, and it was still light, but just getting into dusk slowly. And then my mum came out. My aunt was staying from America. My mum came out and says, dinner time. So we went and had dinner. And I was just feeling kind of this like, ooh, maybe maybe it's happening. Maybe I've found a way that we can be men together. We can be friends. We can. And then he'd been drinking while we were smoking. And then he was on his fourth or fifth whiskey in the middle of the meal. He looked at my aunt and he said something like, he said, out of the blue, he said, yeah, well, you would say that because you're a nigger lover.
And just like that, the hands shut tight.
And there was this kind of like, and then my mum, who was well versed in what was going on, said, right, okay, now I think we'll have pudding now. You know, it's kind of like bustled about and became busy. And it was just like someone had just kind of like, I'd opened up my defences to him. And he just kind of stabbed me. I'll never do that again. He would get on the whiskey. He was an alcoholic of a sort, kind of an alcoholic, kind of not. So he was very rigid in his routine. That was one of the ways he dealt with the world. So at 7 o'clock every night, he would break open the whiskey. He'd get through a couple of bottles of whiskey a week, and as the evening wore on, he would become. You just sense the explosion coming. It was coming and coming and coming. So every night that I was at home, because I went to boarding school, which was one of my, that's another story, but every night I was at home, every family dinner time, every night was about containing his anger, usually unsuccessfully. So by the time we got to dessert, there would be some, and it would usually be anger against my mum, because she was the safe target. He never hit my mum and he never hit us, and it was only later that he would show anger towards me, and then not much. So it was always a sort of a safe anger. He was a big guy. He was bigger than me, heavier than me, went bright red in the face and would just yell. And I understand now that that was about all of the emotion that he had, but he couldn't feel, would be loosened by alcohol and come out as anger. Anger was the only emotion. The only emotion I ever saw him display, bizarrely, strangely. After my daughter died, so I had a daughter who died in 2003, and I went home after she, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks after she died. He didn't come to the funeral because he made up an excuse. He didn't come to his own granddaughter's funeral, basically because we knew, in such an emotionally charged atmosphere, he would have been absolutely out of his depth. So it was the first time I'd seen him. The first thing he said to me, you got me going about my dad now, I won't stop. The first thing he said to me when I got off the plane at Heathrow was, you've put on weight. Which I had. I mean, grief does weird things to your body, and I had put on weight. But so imagine that. The first time you see your son who's just lost his daughter, the first thing you say is, you've put on weight. And then at that time, that was the only time I saw him cry. I wrote about this later in the book, and it was a single tear. It was just a single tear as I showed him photographs of the funeral that he didn't go to. So I don't drink much. A bit. It's not a big deal. I mean, I have a beer, so, but I don't drink much. I think I'm naturally, but I'm a very emotional person. I cry easily, and I'm very proud of that. I cry easily, and I laugh easily too, and I like that too. I am obsessive about intense exercise. So I am, by a long way, actually, I'm the fittest person that I know, fittest man I know of my age. And you know, I just ran a half marathon with my son, which was a beautiful thing to do. I beat him by 15 minutes, and he's 19 and fit too. So that comes from my relationship with my dad. So a lot of who I am and a lot of the way I see manhood is in... my dad was my greatest teacher, without a shadow of a doubt. And the person who caused me the most pain and the most... for years and years and years, I tried as a child to have a relationship with him. My identity as a human being, and absolutely and particularly my identity as a man, is in distinction to all of that.
That story was by Jake Cupid, who collected that interview for an audio series he makes called Man of the Hour. It's a show that takes a short look at masculinity and the many definitions it has. If you like Jake's style and you want to hear more of his stuff, you can find the rest of the Man of the Hour series on SoundCloud by searching Jake Cupid. That's C-U-P-I-T-T. We'll pop a link up at the website. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden, and our next story takes us to a shopfront window in Melbourne's Fitzroy, where two women are conducting a little experiment, all in the name of art. Lindsay Green brings us a story, and just a reminder, there's some strong language.
Because we went in thinking that this would be such a
struggle.
Like, we thought we were going to be the next, like, Girls on Survivor or something. Like, we're going to not eat for 5 days and, like, we're going to be so smelly and gross. But it was just the complete opposite. It blew my mind. It was like, this wasn't our intention in the slightest, but we've actually turned into the celebrities that we were not mocking, but, you know, experimenting with in a way.
Yeah.
This is Nikki.
Hi, I'm Nikki.
And Tamsin.
I'm Tamsin.
They teamed up for a performance at this year's Melbourne Fringe Festival called Display Life. It started with a really simple question.
Can we live off social media?
For 5 days, Nikki and Tamsin lived in the shop window of the Rosetron Costume Store in Fitzroy, Melbourne. They had no food or bedding or supplies. They only had their phones. Could they live entirely off social media for 5 days? By getting people to donate them everything they needed? The idea for the show started with the shop window.
Because it is so small and it's part of a shop, we knew it wasn't going to be anything that, like, your standard sort of theatre show. We knew we had to think outside the box.
Yeah,
and
we both, like, both being actors, we knew we wanted to do sort of a theatre show kind of thing in the window. But as we were brainstorming ideas, we thought, oh, it's a window, so you wouldn't be able to really hear or connect. You know, it's really a voyeuristic thing with the audience watching it. So how would we be able to create something that would really translate well in a window? And then we kind of went, look, we've got to go back to square one, think about what we want to make a show on, what question we want to ask. And then we both came up with this idea looking at social media.
When you hear Instagram celebrities, one of the first names that comes to mind is probably Kardashian.
Nude selfies till I die.
The family, led by matriarch Kris Jenner, has created an empire of television programs, video games, apps, emojis, makeup, fashion, and somewhat questionable weight loss products. Entirely from a curated online presence. But it's no longer just the Kardashians capitalising on this trend. Instagram has become a legitimate career choice for a number of internet personalities, like models, personal trainers, and various social media influencers. Nikki and Tamsin wanted to explore how social media celebrities experience life through a screen, to see how it feels, and to see if they could reap the same rewards, which some people in their lives thought could be a bit risky.
My mum was concerned about, like, the voyeuristic thing in a bad light, because Gertrude Street is, you know, there's lots of clubs around the area, there's lots of nightlife. She was just concerned about, you know,
Safety. Yeah, I had a few people just say that they would hate to not shower for 5 days, you know, or sleep in a window for 5 days. I think just the whole idea freaked some people out, but then, you know, they loved it as well because they still wanted to come see it.
I wondered if there was a moment where they were in the window thinking, what did we sign up for?
The first, like, minute that we went in, we were like, what the fuck have we just done? And then we were just sitting there, like, looking out the window, I reckon, for, like, a good 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And we were kind of like, so what now?
What do we do? I was like, cool, we're going to be bored. We need to come up with interesting things for us to do. Hopefully, like, we were begging someone would bring us pens, you know, something to keep our minds active.
Like, that was a board game or something.
Yeah, and then it just started. Everything just flooded in.
Nikki and Tamsin said that it didn't take long until donations started coming in. They got the necessities like food and water. But it wasn't long until brands and companies got in touch with them, wanting to send them things like alcohol, clothes and stationery. In return for all of their donations, Nikki and Tamsin would post about them on social media. Thanks Sav Martino for our glorious coffee, and to the folks at Archie's. Thanks Slug Boy for worrying about us. These chia bars are getting us through the lunchtime hungries. Good morning! We aren't feeling super fresh this morning. Thanks heaps to the coffees, Sabina and Shelley.
I can't actually explain how busy it was. When you do any sort of other show, you have, you know, maybe you know you've got half an hour until you're on stage, you can mentally prepare, you go on stage, you expel all your energy, you connect with everyone in the audience as much as you can, and then you're done. And you can go back inside yourself, but the window doesn't let you do that. It's constant. Like every 5 minutes, 10 minutes, a new group of people, someone else, and everyone wants to interact. From just waving or smiling to like full conversations via pen and paper through the window.
Yeah.
It never stopped. It was exhausting.
Crazy how much we didn't expect that either. Because we both thought we're going to be bored out of our brains. We're going to drive each other crazy by the end. I feel like we barely even spent time together. It sounds so ridiculous because we were physically and literally together in the window, just the two of us. But we were that distracted the whole time that it just was like a whirlwind.
The Rosetrong costume shop where Nikki and Tamsin were living is almost at the end of Gertrude Street in Fitzroy, in Melbourne's inner north. The suburb is notoriously hipster. Think street art, vintage stores, festivals, and of course, coffee. Nikki and Tamsin thought that this was part of the reason why their performance was so well received.
There's an art culture in that area, whereas I think if we did it around Chapel Street, for example, it would have been completely different.
If Fitzroy and Gertrude Street are known for their art culture, then Chapel Street and the suburbs around it are more well known for their puffer jackets, BMWs, and the Real Housewives of Melbourne.
Yeah, but I wonder how something like this would go down in like Toorak or something.
That's exactly right. It would be so different.
Especially because also the window did look so messy by the end. Mm-hmm. And somewhere that maybe just doesn't appreciate the arts culture and maybe need, you know, lights to have their street looking a certain way, we just wouldn't have fitted in. Mm-hmm. Like, would have been shunned.
I went to see Nikki and Tamsin at the end of their third day, and I got the sense that the window was starting to take its toll on them. They seemed tired and bored, and just a bit fed up with everything. And personally, I felt pretty invasive being there. Even though they were sitting in a public shop window on a busy street, I felt as if I was interrupting a moment of privacy, and I didn't want to bother them, so I quickly moved on.
But the final day, I think we were probably the worst to come and look at. We were so exhausted. I don't think we gave everyone as much attention as we did the other days. There was too much, like we couldn't keep up with it. Yeah, and as soon as we'd have downtime, we wouldn't want to.
It was like, we've got to
take a photo.
And I reckon they would feel like that, like certain celebrities for sure.
And I wasn't, oh, that surprised me too, at how much that became a chore, because that, you know, always seems like a bit of a fun thing, like a really easy way to post about brands in the celebrity world, like a super easy thank you. But if they get inundated as much as we did, it's not fun.
No. It was like a job in itself, being in the window, interacting, posting, which sounds ridiculous because we're sitting on our asses for 5 days, but we were doing things.
That's what's constantly so surprising about it, and so it's so hard to explain.
Yeah, like, and you never would have guessed it going in there until you've experienced it. It was so unexpected how busy we were.
Not only were they exhausted, they also started to feel really guilty about how much stuff they were receiving.
It was almost like, you know, we were living somewhat, like maybe as a homeless person, not at all as anywhere near as bad as anything.
But probably the closest I've ever felt to living under that situation.
How generous everybody was and how much they wanted to be involved and donate things. But would they do that for somebody on the street? Like, that's what really made me feel really guilty.
It's amazing, actually. We talked about that so much. That, like, that's probably the one conversation that we had in the window the most. Like, and it's not something that I thought would come out of this at all. Not saying that we're not.
No,
because I think about this stuff in general in the world. Like, we're
obviously, we need food and water to survive the 5 days. We won't die, but we'll probably be starving and feel really unwell if we don't eat or drink water. But then by the end, I just felt so overwhelmed and so guilty that it could be going to somebody who really, really needs it.
It's hard to have a lot of empathy for the social media celebrities Nikki and Tamsin were inspired by, when there are so many people out there who are really in need, and they seem to get it all for nothing. But I never quite realised how much there is going on behind the scenes of all of this. We feel as if we know these people, based on a few images per day on Instagram, or a couple of minutes of a Snapchat story. But how much can we really know? We're allowed a tiny glimpse into these people's lives, and it's up to us to fill in the blanks of what we don't see. Which I guess was the whole point of what Nikki and Tamsin were trying to explore.
Part of what we were trying to do was show, if you walked past the window, you could see everything. You could see all the mess that we'd accumulated in there. You could see us being exhausted and not putting on those happy faces. Like, we want to show the behind the scenes. Like, you can see our posts and then you can come see us in person and see the not glamorous side. Yeah. You know, we might take a photo and we're behind us, it looks very pristine and white, but surrounding us is all this rubbish, like the dirty clothes, the fact that we slept exactly where we're sitting, but it's not in the frame. But if you come past, like, you can't see all of that. We're not hiding it.
That story was by Lindsay Green, with help from supervising producer Beth Gibson. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beck Fiery is our SYN Production Manager. My co-host is Jess Hamilton. And I'm Michael Bryden. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can also find our archive at allthebestradio.com, and while you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.